Welcome to episode 7 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. Hello, my name's Peter Moore. Today we're leaving the familiar pathways of recent history behind for a trip to late antiquity. We're going to be talking about the great libraries, temples and ideas of the ancient world and how they were very nearly lost as one era gave out to another. For me, writes the historian Dr. Violet Moller, the history of ideas has always been the most fascinating aspect of our past. Discovering how people approach the fundamental questions about our planet and the universe, how they pass the theories on to future generations and expanded different tiers of intellectual knowledge is compelling. In her book, The Map of Knowledge, Violet shows how a treatise written, for example, by the Greek physician Galen has reached us today. Through what hands and which libraries has it passed? Where was it recopied? By whom and into what language? At what moments were the fragile ideas that it contained in danger of being lost forever? Today, Violet is going to play the role of historical guide to tell us much more about all of this. Her book, The Map of Knowledge, has won the Royal Society for Literature's Gerwood Prize. It was published this February in the UK and the USA. The Daily Telegraph has called it popular intellectual history at its best. I met up with Violet in London at her publisher's the other day to talk about one crucial year in this broad story of the history of ideas. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Violet.
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you. Let's get going with a bit of history. The Map of Knowledge looks at how knowledge was really transferred the millennium between the Romans and the Renaissance. But as ever, we've asked you to pick just one year of this broad and billowing story, and you've chosen the year 529.
I've chosen 529 because it's one of the very few dates when we can be relatively sure, because obviously in this period it's always very difficult to have any certainty about when exactly things happened. But in 529 or thereabouts, two or three things happened which were to have really profound consequences for the transmission of knowledge. The first thing was that Justinian passed a law banning pagans from teaching. And this was to have a knock-on effect in Athens because the Neoplatonic Academy then had to close. Meanwhile, across the sea in Italy, St. Benedict was in the process of founding the monastery of Monte Cassino. So those three events happened.
And they coalesce in this year 529.
Exactly.
I know right at the beginning of your book, actually. You start, of course, with a map. So should we just sketch in a verbal way what the map of Europe was like in the year 529, because there's been lots of changes. I suppose, you know, and this is one of the things you write about in the book, we sometimes have a clear picture of what the Roman world looked like, and we have an idea what our world looks like from the Renaissance onwards. But what was happening in about 529 geopolitically?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the geographic scope of my book and my maps in my book are always a little bit bigger than that. They really have the Mediterranean at the centre, and then, of course, Europe, but also North Africa and quite a lot of the Middle East, because this story does involve that whole area. And I think that's one of the things about the history of ideas that perhaps why they're so interesting, but also why they're sometimes not taught in schools in a very good way, is because history
is certainly not on the curriculum, is
well,
it?
Well, no, yeah, exactly. But it can be quite bound by national boundaries. Yeah. And of course, ideas, you know, they travel. So at this point in 529, the Roman Empire has effectively disintegrated in the West, and Italy is being ruled by a tribe called the Ostrogoths, who have conquered the whole peninsula. Spain is under the rule of some other Goths. And meanwhile, over in Constantinople, in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, the area under their rule has shrunk quite considerably, that it is still the seat of the empire. So to speak, and there's still an emperor. So things are looking quite different from how they did a couple of hundred years before.
Yeah, the famous Goths and Vandals, they often
and the Alans
together.
Don't forget the Alans.
They
as
always
well.
Get forgotten about. Who
yeah,
are the,
they
who
do.
Are the Alans?
They were another Gothic tribe. They played an important role in Spain, I think.
But I suppose, so that's the geopolitical part of the story. But if we're looking at this in terms of development of human history, or how we might divide up these, the chronology of the historical story in schools, we're really talking about late antiquity, aren't we? Or late antiquity turning into the next period, which is going to be the Middle Ages.
Yes, absolutely. So the old structures of the ancient world have started, you know, are in decline, and the Christian church is hugely on the rise, and it's sort of taking over from the traditional, certainly in Western Europe, from the traditional Roman structures, especially in Italy, and the power is moving towards the church. And also, of course, education. You know, if you want to learn to read, the schools, many of them have already been closed, but in Italy, some of them still remain in 529. But then a few decades later, the Lombards arrive, and they really do spell the death knell for the sort of traditional classical schools. And after that, if you want to learn to read, really your only option is a monastery.
Okay. With that, I think it's a good time to dive. You know, we ask you to pick your three scenes to evaluate. The first one you've chosen is in Constantinople, and we have the Emperor Justinian rewriting the legal code and issuing a decree making it illegal for non-Christians to teach.
Well, Justinian was just this amazing character. He really is someone who, when you read about him, he feels very alive. And he became emperor on the death of his uncle, who was called Justin. And Justinian had changed his name to Justinian when he was brought to Constantinople by his uncle and sort of adopted. And it's the most amazing rags to riches story. I mean, it's social mobility on a scale that, you know, even today, I think people, you know, it's hard to dream of. So this family were peasants in Illyria, which is in the Balkans. And Justin set off apparently with a bag of grain to make his fortune in Constantinople. And he entered the army and, you know, very quickly made his way up through the ranks. And at some point he sent for his young nephew, who then changed his name to Justinian and was brought up in Constantinople and given, you know, a good education. And it was really wise of Justin. And you can completely understand why he would have done this. You know, he was a man on the make. He wanted to reach the top. But, you know, he was a peasant. He had no sort of familial ties or that sort of background that an aristocrat would have had. So he called for his nephew. And I mean, you have to assume that he'd seen something in Justinian when he was a child that, you know, made him think that this was going to be a success. And between them, they managed to rule the empire. I mean, Justin was ruler until 565. So, I mean, he was ruler for many, many decades. Justin dies. Justinian has already really been ruling with him. And he takes over. And the first thing he does is order the complete overhaul of Roman law, which is by this stage in the most terrible mess.
So this is the point that we're meeting him, is that right?
Yes.
So 529, he's now the emperor.
Yeah.
Known, traditionally known as Justinian the Great.
Yes.
Which might give you a bit of a clue into how history is interpreted his time.
Yes.
And really the last Roman emperor in a way. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, well, he was always known as the last of the Romans because the legal codes which he had drawn up, some were written in Latin and some were written in Greek. But this was really the last moment when official documents, when Latin was the language. So from this point on, Greek is the language that's spoken. And for a while, there's a degree of bilingual activity. But before long, Latin is completely forgotten. And there's this linguistic schism and cultural schism between the empire in the east, which is Greek, and the Byzantine Empire as it becomes known, and then of course Italy and the former western part of the empire, which is Latin. And of course it has profound consequences for learning, because books which are in Greek in Italy, people can't read them anymore, so they're not recopied, and so that's a very interesting aspect of the story.
Yeah. So let's try and get a handle on Justinian. I went searching before this to see if there was any visual representations, and there's a fresco, of course.
There's a beautiful mosaic.
There's a mosaic.
Of him and his wife, Theodora,
I think this is maybe the one that we're talking about. Yes, the one in Ravenna. Yeah. And he looks, I'm not sure if this is an idealised picture of what they imagined the great Roman emperor should look like, but he's, you know, quite a good-looking chap. He's got these great oval eyes. He's very swarthy and dark, and
yeah.
He looks like the kind of person he might
lovely
get
dark
down.
Hair.
Yeah, he might get down to business in a way, and so we can imagine him in a visual sense. But we know, of course, more about his life than that. And you touched on one of the really important things here, which was his work with the legal code. And do you want to talk about that just for a moment, what he did?
So he ordered the overhaul of the legal code, because by this stage, you can imagine, you know, it's been several centuries since Roman law was instituted, and it's been growing. The body of laws has been growing in this very ramshackle, uncontrolled way. And there's a lot of evidence in the period leading up to Justinian's rule, you know, people complaining about what a nightmare the law is and how you can't get justice, and it's all so confused and it takes so long to get your case heard and sorted out. So he orders this overhaul, and what's amazing about it, he sets up a sort of committee of 10 jurors, men, to 10 lawyers to look through it all. And this is in 528 when he's just become emperor. And within a year, I mean, can you imagine nowadays? That's the kind of thing that would take 10 years. It would go way over budget.
Oh, yeah.
We're
quite accustomed to delays at the moment, aren't we? So,
yeah, well, Justinian didn't put up with that kind of thing. So within a year, they had done it.
Right.
And they actually ended up having to redo it and take a little bit longer. And that is those are the documents that we actually have, and which went on to become the basis of you know, law all over Europe, and that was a few years.
Is this so? Is there a connection here? Is this a very obvious connection, or am I overreading things with the name Justinian and justice? Is there a connection, or is that just happens to be maybe a bit of a coincidence?
I don't know. I mean, probably.
Well, we can look into that one. But yeah, as you say, it's massively significant, because this moment here that we're talking about, interpreting, I suppose 1,000 years later in the Renaissance has this explosive effect. Is that right?
Even before that, the legal code, Justinian's legal code, is taken throughout Europe and becomes the basis, for example, at the University of Bologna in the 12th century when the university systems, universities are founded and the university educational system is sort of begun in Europe. And law is one of the absolute foundations of this and the study of law, and it's this legal code. And that is why so many European countries today, the legal code is based on Justinian's legal code originally. So, I mean, it's really profoundly influential as a body of knowledge. It's amazing.
Really, really crucial moment. The one thing we've not talked about so far is Constantinople as the geographic location where this happened. Obviously, it's a fabulous setting on the banks of the Bosphorus. And that was really where the Roman Empire was being controlled from by this point. Is that right? Because there's been the schism that you talked about.
Yes, this is the capital very much, and has been for quite a long time. Justinian, one of the other things he did was also a lot of rebuilding and remodeling, redesigning the city and making it into, you know, more beautiful and also a better functioning place to live.
Yeah, so Constantinople as a setting is vivid.
Yeah.
And I suppose if we go into a bit of conceptual time travelling at the moment, to go back to Constantinople would be to have a vivid setting and see a very, very able administrator going about his work. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And another very interesting thing you briefly touched on is that he was married to the Empress Theodora. And I mean, that story is really, you know, incredibly romantic, wonderful story. They fell in love. She was the daughter of a circus trainer. And this was before Justinian had become emperor, and he persuaded his uncle, so the story goes, to change the law, because by this stage, although he was born a peasant, he counted as a member of the elite, and there was a law saying that if you were part of the elite, you couldn't marry a low-born person. And so he had the law changed so that he could marry Theodora. And they were just this incredible couple who both came from very, very low down in society, but who were there ruling, and she, you know, she had a lot of influence influence over him. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like they were a modern couple, but I mean, compared to, I think, a lot of male-female relationships in that period, you know, she was really played a really important role. And I think that's such an interesting aspect of him.
It's an interesting aspect. It's a nice sideshow as well, because when we're talking about legal codes, it can seem quite dry, can't it? It's very important, nonetheless. I wouldn't want to talk down the law, especially from this part of London, where we have all the law chambers nearby in Chancery Lane. But it really gives you a human side to Justinian as well, if we are to remember him not just for his work as an administrator, but also as a human, you know. And I think this is an important facet of your story which comes down, because we're talking about the transmission of knowledge, and personalities are so important in that story, aren't they? You need to have the right person at the right time, and he seems to be like a crucial one.
Yes, and I think from my point of view, from the type of history that I try to write, you know, the history of knowledge can be quite dry. And, you know, certainly, academic studies, you know, they can be quite complex. And so what I always try to do is to bring the human beings who were behind it to the fore. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about studying history, is that human nature doesn't change. So even though we're separated from these people by hundreds and hundreds of years, you can still imagine them as people, and you can still, and as you say, you know, you find out that Justinian fell in love with this woman. I mean, that's a love story. That, you know, that's just a completely universal truth.
And so let's just imagine it at the moment. So we're on the banks of the Bosphorus, as I said before, the city of Constantinople, capital of the late Roman and Byzantine Empire, and one of the really last great cities of that ancient world, I suppose. And something that's happening in Constantinople at the moment, which is worth, at the moment I'm talking about 529, but something that would have been very apparent to people at that time, is the amount of church building that's going on. This is something, because I looked into this before and I was really intrigued, and this is something you note in the book as well, because you have to erase all Islam from that part of the world at this time, because it doesn't yet exist.
Exactly.
Which is kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? So you have quite a Christianizing city at this point, don't you?
You do, and, you know, a big part of Justinian's program of rebuilding, so he remodeled the Hagia Sophia, and even within, you know, the legal code, one of the things he was trying to do was to Christianize it, because obviously this legal code is Roman, so it's pagan. And during this period and before, there was a lot of work being done to assimilate the bits of classical culture that the Christian church wanted, and to Christianize them, and to sort of inject Christianity into it, or if you look at it the other way around, fit classical ideas into a Christian framework. And that was, I think, one of the things that he was trying to do with his new legal code.
Okay. I think that's a sideshow, but we're going to get onto it very soon and we'll talk about it in more depth. But should we just take Justinian's story out a little bit before we leave him? Because I suppose it's nice to imagine going to see him at work, or maybe, you know, passing whatever laws it was to put in process this copying down of the legal code. But his story is bigger than that as well, isn't it? We talked about him being Justinian the Great, and maybe his greater project during his time was to reunify the Roman Empire, to really bring it back to its former glory. Is that right?
That's right, yes. So while he was being educated in Constantinople when he was younger, he made friends with this Belisarius character who went on to become his general and who reconquered huge swathes, you know, I mean, Italy and Sicily and parts of Spain and North Africa from the Gothic tribes. It was a huge triumph, and he really felt as if he was going to be able to return the empire to its former glory. But unfortunately, it was very short-lived, and within a few decades of his death, all the gains that he'd made had been lost again.
So it really was the last of the Romans in that sense.
Yes.
Do any, because your book is so rooted in manuscript history, do any manuscripts from this time survive, to your knowledge?
Not that I found, but I was obviously focusing very much on three subjects, maths, medicine and astronomy.
So law was a bit beyond your scope for this.
It was. I mean, the earliest copy of Euclid's Elements was actually complete copy, was made in Constantinople, but not until 888. So quite a lot later than Justinian. But there must be, I'm sure there are. I mean, definitely there'll be Bibles and that kind of thing. And actually later on, I was going to talk about a Bible, which is a little bit later, but is more that period.
Okay. Well, I think that's vivid anyway, because we've got the great city, we've got the great emperor, we've got the great project, and focusing too on this idea of law, which is going to be carried over and become enormously useful, apart from anything else, for us today. We still talk about having our law based on the old Roman ideas, so I suppose this is maybe one of the sources for that. Okay, let's go from your first scene. Let's leave Constantinople behind for somewhere else. Where would you like to go?
So I'd like to go to Athens, which by this stage is not the city that it once was. But there is still a degree of learning going on there, and there is still an academy. It's not the same academy or building or place as Plato's academy. It's been refounded, but it is a Neoplatonic academy where there are pagan teachers, philosophers, and they have been very much struggling against this inexorable tide of Christianity, and they're about to receive the sort of final blow, really.
Okie dokie. Well, let's get into Athens, because I suppose, as you pointed out there, this isn't the famous academy, is it? Which was, I think, destroyed several centuries earlier. And we have that famous description of Cicero's, I think, which is when he goes to the spot and sees all, you know, abandoned and desolate. And it's, I suppose this is in the first century BC, that would be. So the Neoplatonic academy, is this a kind of a revival of the old idea of the academy, which has been carried on in the same spirit but in a different place maybe later on?
Yes, exactly. And it's also a continuation of pagan faith and Platonic philosophy, and it's been developed, and you know, a time has gone by, but it's known as the golden chain. It's this link going right the way back to Plato himself.
Okay.
And yes, it's been refounded but it is very much the same ideas which are being
so it's an 800 900 year like intellectual heritage. If it's a golden chain, it's a very long one.
Yes, exactly.
And if we're going to go to the academy itself, I suppose it just conjures up in our minds. Well, I suppose you've got this connection with the Bodleian Library, haven't you, in Oxford?
Yeah, I do.
And I think anyone who uses libraries regularly can maybe empathise with the strange sensation you get when you go into a place which is piled high with books, which has got that intensity of learning and the human, but it's kind of solitude mixed with intellectual energy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the best. Libraries are the best places on earth, I think.
I think they are. And so this is a great example of that, really, isn't it?
Yes,
so
absolutely.
The Neoplatonic academy in Athens. You go in and imagine, you know, this link to Aristotle and Plato, maybe not quite to Socrates, but a long way back nevertheless.
Yes, exactly. And they were, you know, they were sort of keeping the flame burning, not only of their faith, but also of teaching and of these very, very important intellectual ideas. And so when they get the news from Constantinople that pagans are no longer allowed to teach, this is really, this is a really serious moment for them.
Can we unpack this word pagan, which is quite a loaded word to the modern ear, but I suppose you're using it as a catch-all term, really.
Yeah.
Everything that kind of wasn't Christian.
Yes, exactly. And there were, as you say, it was a huge amorphous collection of different belief systems, and a lot of pagan faiths were very localized, and you would worship local deities who would control the weather and crops and that kind of thing. But of course, you know the Greeks and the Romans also had their gods who were worshipped, like Apollo and Zeus and all of them. So it has become a very loaded term, but it does cover this huge amorphous group of different beliefs.
Okay, and you've told us the news has arrived in Athens that
they're no longer allowed to teach. And of course, the philosophers in the academy, that is their main role. They are teachers, and if they can't teach, they can't pass on the knowledge and their faith. And that obviously will make it very, very difficult for their belief to carry on.
So it's really like a full stop at the end of a very, very long sentence, maybe for this group of thinkers. So what happens?
So for a couple of years, they stay in Athens and they try to carry on. But there's a lot of oppression by the authorities, and there's stories of, philosophers being tortured and imprisoned. You know, the authorities try to get them to give up names of other philosophers. And after a few years, Damascius, who's the leader, says, this is no good. We just can't carry on like this. We're going to have to leave Athens. So they set off. And there's a beautiful description of this in Catherine Nixie's book and the Darkening Age, and she imagines them packing up their books and then, as you say, walking through Athens in the footsteps of Plato and Aristotle, and then leaving and setting sail for the Eastern Mediterranean. And from there they go to the Persian Empire, because they hear that the Persian king Khosrow the first is interested in philosophy and trying to promote learning in his empire. So they go there in the hope that they will be welcomed and they will be given the freedom which they haven't been given in Athens.
It's a hugely symbolic moment, isn't it? Well, the picture of them all getting into their ship and setting sail. I suppose in Athens there would be, which it's not quite right to talk about books, is it? Because maybe that's slightly anachronistic, books maybe weren't. But in terms of knowledge, everything must have been there, from that great golden age of the Greeks. So we're thinking of all the works of Plato, of course, and everything that came after from Aristotle, who seemed to publish on everything. So it's all just going into a boat, is it?
Well, I think so.
What happened?
I mean, we don't know what they took with us, but I don't think that you're speculating too much if you say they would have taken their books. I mean, they're scholars. That I think their books would have been the most precious things they owned, apart from possibly the statues that they had in shrines and that kind of thing. But they were, they would have been much less portable than their books. So imagine being able to know what they took.
We had this slight detour earlier on in this scene to the Bodleian Library. And anyone today, I suppose, can imagine walking into a library and seeing the stacks of books. How different to that was this academy, because there wouldn't obviously be shelves of books, would there? Would it be a big space with people? I mean, you do have the famous depiction in Rome, is it not, by Michelangelo, of people sitting cross-legged reading through things.
Yes, I think the first thing is that most of their books would have been scrolls.
Yeah.
So they would obviously look very different. The book, as we know it, the codex, was only really coming into use in about this period. And it was very much associated actually with Christianity. So pagan culture was much more written on scrolls. And I think they would have been kept on shelves or in cupboards. And I imagine that the academy would have included a temple and a shrine, would have been very beautiful, and these kind of places often included a grove, trees and a garden, and I think it probably would have felt even more magical than the Bodleian Library.
Oh wow, I'm thinking of somewhere like the Huntington Library in California, where they've got these great botanical gardens.
Oh, I haven't
all
been
around
there, but yeah, that's
so maybe for your research you should go and have a look at that one. But we're talking about knowledge being written down or copied down physically. How frail were these papyrus scrolls?
It's interesting because they were frail, and especially because if you can imagine, you have your scroll, you had to wind, I mean they were normally about 3 meters long, so you had to wind them in order to read them, and this constant winding and unwinding did make the papyrus even more fragile and liable to tear. But if papyrus was kept in Egypt, in the desert, in the very arid conditions, then it actually could survive a long time. And there is an example, and I can't pronounce the name of the place, but it begins with OX and it's got a lot of Ys and Rs in it. But they found this amazing rubbish tip, which was full of fragments. So they're broken, but they survived, these small pieces of papyrus. And I think scholars have have gone through, I mean, a tiny percentage of them. And, you know, they found a bit of Euclid's elements in there. And there's still loads and loads and loads that needs to be identified and looked at. So it could survive, but it's not, it wasn't a durable material. Not like parchment, which of course came late, you know, which was also used and was especially used in books, which is much, much stronger.
But so I suppose when I'm just, what I'm getting at here and what I'm trying to build in the scene is that knowledge is fragile anyway. We know that it can be lost quite easily. But moments like this, when you have to transfer knowledge physically across space, we don't quite know. We know it's going over towards Persia, but this is an easy time to leave something behind, or for something to fall overboard, or for something to get ripped.
Or get wet in a storm. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the map of knowledge with this description of the amount of knowledge that has been lost. And it's such a striking thought that, you know, it's very arbitrary what survives and what doesn't. I don't know if we transpose that onto our own times, it'd be like, I mean, maybe one Bob Dylan album surviving and you didn't know which one it's going to be.
Would it be one of the best ones?
Yeah, I know. It could be one of the really, really bad ones. And everyone would be wondering what the fuss is about. That's maybe a funny way of putting it. But I suppose that's the... I suppose the anxiety about this scene as well, that it is in moments like this in 529 when you have this suppression of the Neoplatonic Academy, that things can go really badly wrong, can't they?
Yeah, and maybe we did lose. Maybe that was the moment when things got lost. I think that's one of the really compelling ideas is that, you know, there would have been moments when there was one copy left and then that copy was lost. You know, maybe it got burnt in a fire or, you know, or as you say, it was on a ship and the ship sank. The idea of knowledge just being lost, just disappearing, it is a very compelling and terrifying idea.
And we've got this direct connection with the first scene as well, because we've got Justinian, who is passing this proclamation, shall I call it, which is suppressing this academy. Do we know any of the other personalities who are involved at this time in the Neoplatonic Academy?
Well, I think Damascus is the famous one. He's the leader. In the generation before, there was a very famous leader of the academy called Proclus, and he was a real huge force in keeping these Neoplatonic ideas going and trying to stand up against what they called the tyrant, which was Christianity. And he died in the late 5th century. But by this stage, there's not many of them left. You know, I mean, I think if you can imagine living in a world where everybody is converting to a completely different belief system, and a belief system which, the thing about paganism is there was always room for more. You know, there was always room for another deity or another little shrine to something different. And if you look at when the Romans went to Egypt, they just joined the gods together. They just kind of, it was a very relaxed, sort of open system. Christianity is monotheistic. It's God and nothing else. And there's no room for any other gods. I think it must have been extremely devastating to be an adherent of this old system, which you believed in so profoundly, and to realise that you cannot fight against it because it's inevitable. Christianity is going to triumph. There's nothing you can really do about it.
But at those moments, you do get heroes, don't you? And that really is how we can look back at people like Damascus, who do try and carry on the old traditions because they can see. I suppose these are often forgotten heroes as well, because we don't talk about them very often.
Damascus and his crew who set off for Persia, they were basically the last of the Neoplatonists. Christianity was very good at rewriting history and giving people an extremely bad press, or writing them out of history. That's another thing which, you know, you have to think about, is who writes history and who writes the sources that we base it on. And of course, from this point onwards, it's Christianity it's the Christian writers who are in charge. They're dictating the narrative. So, you know, there's lots of heroes from that period before who we just don't even know. We don't even know their names.
But the other thing that I just thought I'd comment on as well, because it's hugely important, and we're not going to be able to talk about this very much today because it's beyond the scope of what we're doing, but the knowledge is going east to Persia. In the very neat and simple narrative of the history of science, you often think, well, there's this kind of great void between the Romans and the Renaissance, but actually, no, a lot happens out in the east, and that's a big part of your book, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Baghdad was the first place where these texts were actively sought and then translated into Arabic, and then not just that, the ideas were taken and worked upon, and the Arabs came up with the most amazing extra They built on the classical scientific ideas and brought it, took knowledge forward.
Which is something beyond just copying them down.
Oh, far beyond. And they took ideas from India and, you know, so if you just take the example of our numeral system that we all use today, the Hindu-Arabic numeral system, the clues in the name, it came from India and in Baghdad, and they wrote about it and tried to popularise it. They weren't very successful initially, but it is thanks to them that the idea came westwards and eventually came to Europe in the Renaissance.
Well, you'll have to go to the book if you want to find out more about that, because we've got our next business is going to take us back west again. Where do you want to go for your third scene from 529?
I'd like to go to a mountain just south of Rome overlooking the Via Latina, and it's called Monte Cassino. And in 529, or possibly 530, I'm not going to split hairs, a man called Benedict of Nursia arrived, and he founded a monastery there. That's the short version.
We'll dig in a little bit further than Benedict's monastery there. This goes on to be so important. It comes back to this moment, doesn't it, in 529, and this particular hill, which is, let's do a bit of geography so we know where we are, kind of between Naples and Rome.
It's overlooking the road from Naples to Rome. It's closer to Rome, I think. The main source we have for his life is written by Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory the Great. And Gregory the Great presents Benedict as arriving in this area and finding lots and lots of adherents to paganism, and he needs to stamp it out, and he needs to get them all to convert to Christianity. And this whole story is told that he goes up onto the mountain where he finds a temple to Apollo and a grove of trees, a sacred grove. And Gregory says that Benedict smashes the statue of Apollo and he overturns the altar and cuts down all the trees in the grove, and then founds a church on the site, which then later becomes a monastery.
It's interesting when we divide history up, and I mean, we generally do it actually in Britain by the reigning monarch, don't we? Say the Elizabethan age tumbles into the next age, tumbles into the next age. When we're looking at these bigger eras in the past, sometimes we talk about late antiquity and the Middle Ages. And when one turns into the next is quite difficult to actually see. But if we were to have a moment, I'd say smashing up a temple of Apollo on top of a hill, turning over an old altar and building a church, that'd be pretty good, wouldn't it?
It's quite a symbolic moment. And I mean, I think probably the truth is, you know, less dramatic and less interesting. It was a very much a trope in Christian writing that, you know, the saint or whoever it was would arrive and find lots of pagans and convert them all and smash the temple. And that was a very traditional idea. Even if he didn't smash a temple of Apollo, Benedict did write his rule of St. Benedict in the monastery of Monte Cassino. And that did go on to be the most important monasticism in the whole of the Middle Ages. I mean, still today, there's 400 Benedictine monasteries today. And so it was a really important moment.
Okay. So, well, there's quite a lot to say here. What do we know about Benedict himself, apart from what Gregory has told us? Or is it quite hazy history at such a distance?
Yeah, there's not a lot of information about him, but we think that he was born into the local aristocracy, was a wealthy young man, and he went to Rome, where he was, I assume, being educated. And while he was there, he sort of decided that this kind of life just wasn't for him, and it wasn't giving him the spiritual succor that he wanted. So he retreated from Rome and went and lived in the countryside outside Rome. And then after a while of living there, he then decided to become a hermit. And he then had a period of time where he was very much living in seclusion and praying and meditating. And then after that, he began founding monasteries. And I think he founded 12. And Monte Cassino was the most important.
But what was different about him that made his type of monasticism more durable and more significant and influential than all the others. Was it his rule that you were talking about? Is that an important feature?
Yeah, that because that was, you know, it was basically a list of rules of how to run a monastery. I mean, it was some of it was quite practical. It was practical information, and then some of it was about the spiritual life and how the monks should divide their day, and how actually reading was quite an important part of what they had to do, private reading, and they also then read out loud, and they read during, you know, they would read out loud to each other. And it was very portable, so it was taken, you know, it was a book of rules which was then able to be applied in all different monastic foundations, and people used it as a sort of blueprint for monasteries.
Absolutely. So within that, where does the transfer of knowledge come in? Because you mentioned before that, okay, you've got this one-size-fits-all religion which comes. And there's obviously as an attempt to make the old ideas fit with this new reality in the paradigm shift. Not everything's going to fit, so some things are going to be lost. But out of the ashes almost, because Christianity is a destructive force culturally in some senses, but equally it becomes a preserver of information as well, doesn't it?
It does, and it becomes a preserver of even just the, you know, the knowledge of how to write and how to read, and it becomes an incredibly, it's a lifeline with regards to education. As I said earlier, you know, if you want to learn to read in the 6th century, really the best place is a monastery, probably your only option. But there was this other man who also founded a monastery, and he was called Cassiodorus, and his dream actually was to found a sort of theological university in Rome, and that, for whatever reason, that idea came to nothing. And so he ended up going to, his family were from Calabria, right on the south in Italy, and he went back to his family's estates, and he founded a monastery, and then which was sort of split into two. So there was a part of it was for hermits who were very much retreated from the world, a retreat effectively, and then the other part was a normal community monastery, and part of that was the scriptorium. And it was really Cassiodorus who put producing books and scriptoria at the very heart of the monastic tradition. Up till then, you know, copying out texts was something that was done by people who, you know, the monks who were old or infirm or couldn't do anything else. They couldn't work in the vegetable garden or whatever. But Cassiodorus said, no, absolutely not. You know, this is a really important job and it needs to be done by people who are specially trained. And so he had a transformative influence on book production. So if you could compare, if you're comparing Justinian's legal code with Benedict's rules, but then you could do a further comparison, which is with Cassiodorus's institutions. He wrote the divine and human institutions, and the divine institutions were a list of books and knowledge, Christian knowledge, that the monks in his monastery should study and the books that they should read. And then the human institutions were all the other subjects, and he included mathematics and astronomy and medicine, and this became the medieval educational curriculum. So it was really, really, really important.
Do we have, from Monte Cassino, any particular manuscripts that survive today that you know about?
Yes, I don't know any manuscripts that survive from St. Benedict's time. And in fact, I don't even know if there was a scriptorium there in Benedict's time. Later on in the Middle Ages, Monte Cassino became extremely important and prolific. But one of the interesting things about the monastery of Monte Cassino is that it was actually founded there three times. A few decades after Benedict, the Lombards arrived, so the monks were dispersed and went into hiding and didn't come back for, I can't remember the exact dates, but I mean, you know, there was, I think, a century, then it was refounded. Then the same thing happened again in the 8th century with when the Arabs arrived, and then it was refounded, I think, in 949. And from then on, that was really when the scriptorium became, you know, really important. But I think that's thanks to Cassiodorus making, you know, manuscript production so important, you know, all those centuries before. But there is one book which there's a picture of it in my book, and it's the earliest medical text known in Europe, and it was produced in the scriptorium of Monte Cassino from the 10th century. So amazing.
And I imagine, I don't suppose actually, if you're setting up the monastery in 529, they probably haven't got round to doing the scriptorium yet, because there's probably other parts
I think, you know, you're probably planning the...
But I'm, you know, I'm...
The defensive walls probably would be first on the list.
Get the Lombards out first. But that would be the most interesting part of a monastery visit for you, wouldn't it? To go and see the scriptorium. And how similar do you think it would be to the Academy in Athens? Do you think there would be similarities in...
that's a great question.
Would it have a very different tone?
Well, I think a lot of the physical attributes would be the same. There would be desks, there'd be pens, there'd be ink, there'd be parchment or papyrus or whatever writing material, and there would be books. But I think the difference is that in the ancient world, book production is very commercial. You know, they're made to be sold, and you know, book production was also on a pretty large scale. So there would have been, you know, rooms of scribes and people reading out a text and making lots of copies at once. And I'm not sure in scriptoriums, in monasteries, it wasn't on the same scale, I don't think. There's one thing which I read about which made me smile, which is that in the, you know, in the monasteries, when they were reading and they were silent, they weren't allowed to speak, if they wanted somebody to pass them a copy of a non-Christian text, they would either make the sign that they were vomiting, like they were retching, or they would make a sign so they looked like a dog scratching their ear. And they were the two signs for... And I think that's quite a funny insight into sort of everyday monastic life and how they viewed non-Christian culture.
Yeah, it's almost like trying to digest some unpalatable food that you know, it might be good for you, but you're not necessarily allowed to enjoy it. Is that maybe the idea?
Yeah, but I think they probably did really enjoy it, because, you know, these classical texts were written in the most beautiful, you know, Ciceronian Latin. I mean, and compared to that, a lot of early Christian writing was really, really not good quality. And early Christians were very aware of this, and they were quite embarrassed about this fact that, you know, culturally they knew they just weren't anywhere near the heights of ancient Greece and Rome. So I don't know, maybe they felt guilty because they were enjoying, I don't know, I'm not a religious person, so I find it quite difficult to put myself in the mindset of an early medieval monk, but who knows?
Well, that's the point of travels through time, I suppose, that you could go back and have a look, and you could maybe witness the cultural cringe on that Monte Cassino hill. It's a hill, it's a rocky hill, isn't it, I suppose. You've given us, I think, a panoramic, picaresque tour through a really interesting year in the past. And it's not one that people would readily choose, but it's one that, having spoken through with you, actually seems quite important to me. The legal code, the end of the Athenian tradition, and the start of a new one, which is going to tumble on and on and on and on through the centuries right the way to the Renaissance. So, not bad. Not bad at all.
Not bad.
We've learnt a lot along the way. Thank you very much. But if you could bring one object back as a memento from this year to 2019, is there anything you'd like?
Yes, definitely. But I don't know if you're going to let me have it. It's a little bit of a cheat. I'd like the chest of books that Damascius and his colleagues took with them.
Oh, right, the ones that went on the...
The ones that went to Persia.
The ones that went to
Can
Persia.
Can I have that, or is that cheating?
No, I think we'll let you have that, in the sense that we'd have to imagine you as some kind of piratical force on the oceans or
like
in the Mediterranean. You could sweep in and take that. And maybe, who knows what's in there?
Exactly.
It could be one of Bob Dylan's best albums.
A book that we've never heard about or have no knowledge of.
Yeah, I suppose that's like a good last question, just to leave us pondering. Is there anything, I'm sure there's so many things, but as you were reading through and doing your research, which you just thought, oh, I wish that existed, and that's such a shame it's gone.
Well, yes, there was an astronomer in the ancient world called Aristarchus, and he suggested that perhaps the sun was at the centre of the universe, and he wrote a treatise about it, which hasn't survived, and nobody sort of took him up on his idea. Everyone thought it was madness. Of course, the Earth is at the centre of the universe, but I would love to have been able to see that.
Oh, well. He got a bit ahead of himself.
He did. Unlucky. 18 centuries before Copernicus.
So. Yeah. Oh, well. Oh, well. Something to moan about. A wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was me, Peter Moore, spending a very enjoyable hour with Dr. Violet Moller in London a few days ago. Her book, The Map of Knowledge, is available in hardback now.
Hello, I'm Artemis. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Travels Through Time with Violet Moller. Listening to Violet and Peter talk about how vulnerable sources of knowledge were to being damaged or destroyed or accidentally thrown off a boat terrified me because it made me realise how much information about the past we've lost. But also, equally, it gave me a revived sense of awe for the sources that do remain. And I particularly enjoyed the picture Violet painted of the monks making gagging actions to communicate with each other about what they'd like to read. Thank you so much for listening. You can expect our next episode on the 2nd of December with the writer and historian William Dalrymple. Till then, goodbye.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. If you want to read more about the year 529 and its legacy, go to historytoday.com/travels-through-time. There you'll find articles by Conrad Leyser on Charlemagne, Muhammad and the fall of Rome, by Jonathan Harris on the rivalry between Byzantium and the Abbasid Empire, and Dionysius Stathopoulos talks about the history of the Eastern Roman Empire. You'll find articles on every aspect of the past, every month in History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. To subscribe, just go to historytoday.com/subscriptions.